TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Anand Giridharadas in conversation on wealth versus democracy. There are very few writers who went on a book tour expecting to be done in 3 months, and 2 years later are still in high demand by TV and radio talk shows, universities, high-level brain trusts, and festivals. Even the Dutch Parliament handed out Anand Giridharadas' book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World, and engaged him in lengthy discussion that was broadcast and archived on TUC Radio. Even the coronavirus didn't slow him down, and on May 19, 2020, Anand Giridharadas was interviewed from his home for the International Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven, Connecticut. In his book, Giridharadas asked hard questions about corporate philanthropy. Why, for example, should our gravest problems be solved by the unelected upper crust instead of the public institutions that the rich erode by lobbying and dodging taxes? Elizabeth Nearing is the curator of ideas for the International Festival of Arts and Ideas. Here she introduces Giridharadas and the interviewer.
Welcome to Wealth in Our Democracy, Anand Giridharadas in a Conversation. The International Festival of Arts and Ideas is created and produced on the traditional lands of the Mohegan, Mashituket Pequot, Eastern Pequot, Scaticoke, Golden Hill Paugusset, Niantic, and the Quinnipiac in the land we call home, Connecticut. I hope that from wherever you are, take a moment and acknowledge and honor the Native people whose lands you're on and the history of the place you're in. I want to thank everybody who's come along with us on this journey. Throughout, we met with folks to ask them to fill in the blank. We can't talk about democracy in New Haven if we don't talk about blank. And wealth inequality came up every time. This conversation today is an opportunity for us to dive in deeper with experts. It's my great pleasure to introduce our speakers tonight. We're welcoming John Dankosky and Anand Giridharadas. Anand is the author of most recently Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. He is the editor-at-large for Time, an on-air political analyst for MSNBC, and he has a new TV show, A Seat at the Table, on Vice. And without any further ado, it is my great pleasure to welcome John and Anand. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you for having us.
Well, thanks so much for having us. Anand, it's good to talk with you. First of all, thanks for being here.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm kind of where I always am. So in a way, it's easier.
I guess it's a lot easier these days. I want to talk about wealth and inequality. And I want to talk about the topic of your new book. And I think I want to start off with a really great object example of what you talk about in Winners Take All. And it happened just in Connecticut today, as a matter of fact. Some news coming from the Connecticut Mirror. I'm just going to read from my colleagues here. It says, Governor Ned Lamont announced the dissolution Tuesday of Connecticut's education partnership with hedge fund giant Ray Dalio's philanthropic group, a deal marred by transparency issues and oversight scandals less than 1 year after its creation. The final straw appears to be centered on Dalio officials' efforts to remove the partnership's executive director days before state lawmakers had been notified about the problem. So I won't go into all the details, Anand, but you've written quite a bit about efforts like this, where really, really rich people want to do something really, really good to help the people of the place where they live. And the Dalio Foundation, in many ways, was trying to do that, putting in $100 million, asking the state to kick in $100 million, leveraging more private money to try to help transform education in the state. It didn't work, and we can get into some of the reasons why, but this seems so emblematic of exactly the sort of thing that you've been following. What's so wrong in your mind with this sort of effort by a guy like Ray Dalio?
You know, if the rich and powerful giving back were going to save us, Connecticut would have been saved by now. Mm. America would have been saved by now. And the Dalio thing, I'm so glad you brought it up. I haven't thought about him in a few minutes. And so I'm glad you brought him back up to my consciousness. And I might not, you know, be able to sleep tonight with all the nightmares picturing his face. But it is such a perfect encapsulation of how this whole thing works, right? So let's start small and then we can kind of take it bigger. I started the investigation that became Winners Take All because I observed something that didn't make sense to me, right? I had a question. And the question was, how is it that we live in this time in which rich and powerful people are giving back more than has ever been given away before? Young people who are elite graduates of top universities are starting social enterprises to help this African country or go to that South American country and change this and change that. You have, you know, this real effort by companies. Every company's got to have a CSR, corporate social responsibility program, so on and so forth. The worse the company, the kinder its CSR initiative and the more prominently displayed in the website. You've got a company that like kills people in its business model with opioids or something like that, then it's like a really prominent display of philanthropy.
Sure.
You know that too in Connecticut. So I started to wonder how all of that sits alongside the fact that those same plutocrats were only increasing their share of the nation's wealth and power every year, actually increasing their share of the pie, hoarding more and more wealth and power, and the American mobility structure was melting down and so on and so forth. And the answer I came to through reporting is that the giving back that these folks do isn't just a drop in the bucket that's failing to deliver against our biggest problems. It is helping to uphold our problems because what these folks do is give just enough and give in certain ways to protect a bad system that benefits them and hurts most people. So now I'll take the Dalio thing. All the things I write about in the book are displayed in this one little incident. First of all, you got a rich guy who's made money through an indefensible industry, the hedge fund industry. I know it's gonna, you know, hurt feelings in Connecticut, but let's be real. An industry that is responsible for financialization of the American economy and so much of the destruction of the American economy. If you're one of those people who feels the economy is not working for you, people like Ray Dalio are a big part of why. Okay, so you start with those economic sins. Then you make a donation like this, which gets way more publicity than decades of what you actually did to working people through your hedge fund. So that works. So you kind of, there's an erasure. That's the first element, right? Suddenly the modest do-gooding is a louder and more visible public story than what you did to harm the society and make the money. Okay. Then you got the second element, which is strings attached. Now you tell Connecticut, I'm going to give you this money, but you got to do this. You got to do this. You got to hire people I like. You got to do this. You got to have the curriculum like this. I don't know. I had my first kiss in college under a, you know, the chemistry building arch. So you got to put some money on chemistry. My uncle got this disease. So you got to fund, you know, doctors who study that disease. This is how rich people operate. So you got the strings attached. So suddenly a sovereign government in the state of Connecticut, people of Connecticut don't actually have sovereign power to shape their own education system. Number two. Then you got this whole issue of lanes. Never get in a car with a plutocrat because they always changing lanes. Elon Musk, right? Public health expert. Mark Zuckerberg, going to reinvent education. Now it's Dalio, just going to swerve into the lane of education. He's got thoughts. And finally, Ray Dalio has famously written a book called Principles. I didn't even know he had any until he wrote the book. Didn't know he had any after he wrote the book. And that's the last part of this loop that I'll mention, which is thought leadership, right? You may think thought leader is a good word. It's not a good word. It's what wealthy and powerful people who want to defend the interests of wealth and power do when they want to turn their interests into something nobler, such as ideas. They write a book like that. And serious people take someone like Ray Dalio seriously, which is incredible. Put him in airports, put him in all these places. And what that does is Ray Dalio then becomes, instead of an economic predator, a guy who's helping people, a guy whose record is erased, a guy who's helping to make the state of Connecticut better, a guy who's a thought leader, who's exuding ideas into the world.
So,
and today in the collapse of this, what we see is the utter folly, not on his part. He's doing what makes sense for someone like him to do. He should play offense. It's for us as a society to learn to play defense. And the state of Connecticut, the United States of America, should not outsource the job of making our society better to rich and powerful people who have no interest in changing the system, just in giving little scraps to actually keep it the way it is.
So here's something, though, that's maybe not just specific to Connecticut, but it comes up in this state in a huge way, and it has to do with civic culture. So, for instance, a few years ago, when the state was kicking around the idea of a public option, a public healthcare option that would provide lower cost healthcare to many more thousands of Connecticut residents, the head of Cigna, got word of this and said, well, if you start doing that, I might pull Cigna out of here. And what that signaled to the state was, well, we don't want to lose those jobs. And the people who work here said, well, Cigna is really important to us. And so I guess I wonder, as you get beyond the Ray Dalios of the world, how do you make that change when there's so many other people who are part of this system, who are making good middle or upper middle class lives yoked up to this thing that is a part of our civic culture?
I'm sorry, there's a lot more people in Connecticut with crappy healthcare than there are people working for Cigna in Connecticut, right? The reality is this is an organizing problem and it's a political problem. The people who want to run America like a casino where they always win are actually not that numerous, right? You're right. There's an employee class that is broader than the CEO plutocratic class. That's true, but they're still a minority. And I actually don't think even they are the principal obstacle to this. All the data shows that it is the very, very, very wealthy who have captured most of the gains of the last 30, 40 years, who monopolize the attention of politicians in Washington with their donations, who monopolize decisions around incentives that states are giving, whether it's Amazon in New York or Connecticut thinking about keeping a company like Cigna or not. And I just think actually we have not mustered the courage to say we have a great country. We have a phenomenal country. And it's time that we actually played poker with these companies and these plutocrats and say, you know what? If you really want to operate your company in the United States of America, you want access to our market. It's a great market. You want to recruit from our universities, some of the best in the world. You want the protection of our courts, which are really actually excellent courts. And even Donald Trump can't change that. Then here's the price. Here's the price you got to pay. And if you don't want to pay that price, totally cool, man. Totally cool. No issue. We are 25% of the world's demand or whatever it is, but like totally no hard feelings. If our taxes are too high for you, just go live in Singapore. It's cool. You won't chew gum, but you make a little life for yourself there. And then let's see if all these people whining about higher taxes are actually as determined as they say they are to go to some far, far off country. I have no problem finding out. Let's do a real life experiment.
Well, look, but that's what happens. Not just, big companies maybe playing chicken with the American public and deciding that they're not going to go to Singapore. It happens state to state all the time. This is how we get state incentives like the kind that Connecticut is playing all the time against others. I mean, everyone wants to move to Florida or South Carolina because there's no taxes there and they can pay their employees a little bit less.
But then you got to live in Florida.
And then you got to live in Florida with the hurricanes and you're going to be underwater. But
you're right. The issue between states is different than the issue between countries, right? And I should be clear about that. The way to solve this between states is a federal law that eliminates these races to the bottom, right? That's kind of the whole purpose of a federal government, right? And the most dramatic illustration of this recently is the mask and ventilator situation, where in a pandemic, New York and California are independently sending people to some warehouse in China, like fighting each other, to outbidding each other to get some masks for their people, when in fact the government, and in some cases being like outgunned by the United States or having stuff seized, it was crazy drama. The country should not allow states to do that, right? We are all trying to provide a basic level of existence and decency for people. And the idea that, Amazon, for example, in my state of New York, could run this auction, basically, where it was getting states and localities around the country and internationally to basically outbid each other to who could offer Amazon the greatest tax break. Amazon run by the world's literal richest man. It's just preposterous.
But it gets to the same thing as the Dalio story in a certain way, is that when you start to talk to American politicians or a lot of the people who support American politicians, they say, well, look, I get it. This isn't ideal. We shouldn't be in a bidding war for Amazon. We shouldn't have to rely on Ray Dalio to fund our educational improvements. But what are we going to do? We don't have the money in our budget this year. Shouldn't we get in line and do something about that? I mean, how do we break that cycle when all of these states have these really pervasive problems with just funding themselves, funding the basic social safety net?
Well, to quote my friend Hasan Minhaj, the comedian, we tax that app. You know, there's a lot of ways to get $100 million from Ray Dalio. And voluntary philanthropy, in which he gets to call the shots about how young children are educated in the state of Connecticut, is not the only one. You can do it through a wealth tax. You can do it by closing the carried interest loophole. You can do it by having an estate tax. And you can do it by, frankly, enforcing tax laws. God knows what kind of islands that guy keeps his money on. It seems to me his accountants are better than his barber. And, you know, I just think there is a real conversation we need to have about taxation being fundamentally different from and better than philanthropy as a solution to our biggest shared problems. Philanthropy has some uses. You know, there's some things you actually don't want government doing, maybe like sponsoring the arts because it's going to be cautious. You know, there is a space for certainly philanthropy doing pursuing experiments that government is, you know, just too bureaucratic to pursue. You know, in a moment like this pandemic, there may be a case for a limited use of philanthropy to do fast things that the government may be a little slow at doing. But in general, when it comes to our biggest shared problems, how do you fix social mobility? How do you fix racial wealth gap? How do you, you know, make America whole after 400 years of the, you know, plunder of African Americans? None of these are problems that are going to be solved by comb over billionaires throwing coins at us.
But you're talking specifically about that particular type of philanthropy, not the type of philanthropy where maybe millions of Americans pull together and say, we really want to have something important. I mean, look, I've made most of my career in public radio. And so for me, asking people for money in order to get, you know, a free system of the news is a really, that's a very simple thing. I think that that makes a whole lot of sense. But the type of philanthropy you're talking about is the philanthropy that comes from the richest 0.01% telling us what to do with that money.
Yeah. And to be clear, I mean, I say this in the book, I am using a definition that's sort of the one used in the field by people who study philanthropy, which is really different from what you're describing. You know, philanthropy is different from charity, you know, and it's different from the kind of giving that you're talking about, you know, people wiring in 10 bucks to NPR. And the origin of that term and that kind of usage of it is really 100 or so years ago, when you started to have the first types of fortunes that we'd now call billionaires. They were kind of centimillionaires in those days. Rockefellers, Carnegie, Cooper, those kind of people. And they started giving back. You know, giving was an old tradition. All the religions say you should do it. And you had many to many giving. You did have some rich people giving more. You had feudal lords, you know, doing nice things for the people they were also, you know, still oppressing. But what you had in the beginning of the 20th century was something qualitatively new, which was people who had made such vast fortunes from the Industrial Revolution, just a different scale of wealth relative to regular people, that when they felt this largeness of spirit and decided to start giving back, inherently their acts of giving were quasi-governmental almost, right? They were just simply operating on a scale that is not comparable to sending 10 bucks to the local radio station, right? If they decided they wanted to work on women's rights, they were immediately one of the biggest players in women's rights alongside national governments and state governments. People like the Dalios are helping to govern Connecticut. And I don't know if anybody on this chat or watching this ever voted for a Dalio. But if you didn't, you're being ruled by an unelected king. Until today, I guess.
I want to get to something else that was in the news this week that I'm pretty sure you took a look at. You see this op-ed in the Times as part of their series, The America We Need by Michael Strain. This is titled, The American Dream is Alive and Well. We have bigger issues than inequality. And he starts with a little thought experiment. It's very quick, and I'll read it to you. It says, imagine if you could wave a magic wand and double the incomes of the bottom 20% of Americans. Would you do it? I imagine your answer is yes. Now suppose that in order to increase the incomes of people at the bottom by a factor of two, you had no choice but to increase the incomes of the top 20% by a factor of 2.5. Would you still wave the wand? So this is, you know, Michael Strain from the American Enterprise Institute basically making a case in the pages of the New York Times. Inequality isn't really the big issue in America right now. How does it strike you?
Let me see if I can just quickly read you something. Yeah, I'm just looking at the funders of AEI. It's always very helpful. Philip Morris seems to have donated quite a bit. The cigarette company ExxonMobil seems to have donated quite a bit. the SCAIF Foundation, I think, I presume, connected to Richard Mellon SCAIF, one of the great right-wing ideologues, chronicled in Jane Mayer's Dark Money. Mike, you know, it's fine to be wrong, but to be wrong on the New York Times op-ed page is an embarrassment. Look, what Michael is doing, I understand the move, right? Because my entire book is a chronicle of the dance moves that people use to uphold plutocracy. And this is one of the dance moves. I'll break down this particular cha-cha for you. The way it works is you do the following. You try to say that there is no connection between the people on the top and the people on the bottom. In fact, the connection may be the one Michael describes, which is the only way to benefit the people on the bottom is to benefit the people on the top even more. That is creating a dynamic that is the win-win, right? The win-win dynamic. And Michael, in what I would say is a, you know, C plus intelligent version of this thesis, this idea fundamentally is trying to suggest that the people down below are not down below because of the people up above. And this move is very, very important now, in particular, in an age of inequality, now in the time of the pandemic, millions of people unemployed. It's very important to say, I see the people down there. I see that mobility is broken. I see that whatever percentage of Americans, half of Americans, don't have $400 for an emergency expense. I see it. Otherwise, you're a crazy rich person if you say, I don't even see that stuff. People have tried that in history. It doesn't work well. Ask Mari. So you got to say you see it. It actually hurts your heart. You might, like Jamie Dimon, or you might even give a statement saying, I condemn this. I bemoan this. I am not okay with this. And I see these people. But then, crucially, you have to say, but they are not down there because I'm up here. In fact, the best way to help them, do like Mike. Lift me up, make me 2.5 times richer, and you'll help them. And in a way, if I was trying to shatter one move above all the others in the book, it was this notion of the win-win, right? Mm-hmm. Because at the heart of the story of America in the last 40 years is the notion that in many important ways, the relationship between those on top and those in the bottom was indeed one of zero sum, not positive sum. And I'll explain a couple ways in which that happens. If you are avoiding taxes, if your way of being on top is avoiding taxes by sending money to weird Caribbean islands, lobbying for the Trump tax cut, lobbying for carried interest loopholes and things like that, right? If your way of doing, keeping your wealth is tax minimization, that is specifically money that is not going to the medical care and education and health of the people on the bottom. Those people are literally getting poorer with every tax dollar you save. If you are lobbying for bottle service public policy that is written for your private benefit in the lounge, upstairs lounge of democracy, not for the benefit of the public, people are literally being impoverished by your being in the lounge. Your being up there is the cause of their staying down there. And they are down there because you are standing on their necks.
Well, one of the primary arguments, though, is I give my tax money to a government which is inefficient, spends it poorly, and unfortunately, in America, at the municipal level, at the state level, at the federal level, we have so many instances of that that play right into the narrative that it is sometimes hard for the regular person to argue against. It's hard to say that giving those billions in tax dollars to an inefficient government might actually do something better for those people on the bottom.
Who said the government's inefficient? Who conceded that point?
I don't know that we have conceded that point, but it is certainly something that has been proven in various cases across municipalities, states, and at the federal level over time.
I think this is a complete piece of horseshit, frankly, that has no basis in fact. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you a few reasons why. First of all, if you go to very poor countries, developing countries, right, which I spent a lot of time reporting in, and you look at what is really different between the United States and these countries, the quality of the private sector is not it. Okay? You go to India, for example, private sector is as good as the private sector in the United States. People are as smart, companies are as good, business sense is as strong, great dynamic market, right? What is different in India is the system. What is different is the regulatory infrastructure. What is different is the fact that you can't go to court in India. Basically, if you're a business, someone steals your plant, you're not going to go to court and get it back. So you have to hire someone to go get, you know, I don't know, some tough to go intimidate someone or hire someone to go bribe a politician, right? You can't, you wouldn't just sue in court, right? Indian parliament is not, frankly, making decisions on an evidence-based way, because until recently, there's something in India called the Parliamentary Research Service, which was new. There was no factual information available to MPs about what were the consequences of the legislation. What makes us different from India is actually the quality of our governance, right? Not our people being smarter, not our companies being better. It's the quality of our systems and our laws, right? So I would actually argue that if you look at how much richer a country like America is than a country like India, you're getting a phenomenal return on governance. You're getting way more out of it. So this is this notion that the government is all like the DMV inefficient. I'm sorry. The United States federal courts, I think, cost $80 billion a year, the U.S. federal courts. Do you know how much economic value the federal courts create? Which business generates a return on investment like the U.S. federal courts? The U.S. federal courts give every person, business person in this country, a complete confidence that if someone like completely fraudulently steals your stuff, you have a place to go. Do you understand how profoundly efficient that is as an investment? Social Security, millions of old people would fall into poverty every single year without Social Security. Which business in America is getting returns like that? Medicare. Who has the overhead in the healthcare industry? Who has the overhead costs of Medicare? Are there parts of the government that are slow and inefficient? Are there some bad people going to government? Sure. Is that any different from finance? I mean, you in Connecticut, you got a bunch of hedge fund people around, private equity people around. How many of them are doing super productive things that improve the human condition every day? I've spent time in Silicon Valley. You're telling me all those people add value to the planet every day?
Sorry to end it here. Just as a friendly fight is beginning between Anand Giridharadas and the interviewer, John Dankowski. But that's all it fits into the time slot for TUC Radio. Please come back for part two. Giridharadas was interviewed at the International Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven, Connecticut, on May 19, 2020. He's much in demand after his book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World, was published in 2018. Giridharadas is an editor-at-large for Time, an on-air political analyst for MSNBC, and a visiting scholar at the Journalism Institute at New York University. Come back when Giridharadas goes into more detail about the efforts of the rich to destroy government. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.